Greetings, everyone. We had a very successful campaign, as you heard Lewis Powell speak of up there, and we were all very surprised and pleased with 308 people who turned out up in Texarkana. So even though Mr. Dart was speaking here last Sabbath, I was speaking nevertheless, and we all felt that it was one of the very best that we had ever had. So we were quite pleased with that group that came out, and quite pleased with the fact that a large number of people put their names on a mailing list and took literature cards as well as arms loads of literature. I had neglected to even think about it, so on the way from our home here to the office, my wife reminded me to take some of the Peter story in hardback, and I stopped by the little room in here and grabbed a box of about 30 copies, I guess. When I got to the Sharp's house, I found that Benny had already been over earlier, and he'd grabbed a box of about 30 copies. We went on up there, and the pastor of both the Little Rock and the Texarkana churches, Mr. John Pinkston, acted as MC. I don't like to sell the books on the Sabbath, so he merely told them what the reduced rate was and said, if you want to pick up a copy, take it, and then at your leisure, you can send in the money later on. I was surprised that by the time I finished speaking, both boxes were empty, and all 60 copies were gone. We did have, of course, probably, what would you say, 75 or 80 or so of our own brethren from both Little Rock and Texarkana, and even a small handful, I guess, that came up from the environs of Longview and so on. But the broad majority of this group, certainly more than 250 of them or so, were brand new, first-time people. I imagine there were some people who had been in the former organization who had dropped out and were no longer attending. There may have even been a few who were still attending who came clandestinely. But we were very pleased and surprised, to say the least, about 308 people up there. So I think there are a lot of reasons for that, not the least of which is the fact that television does reach into the area, that a lot of people have been praying for the campaign. The local church brethren have been working very hard. They had scrabbled together and gotten quite a few $100, maybe even $1,000 or more. I forget the exact amount, I may have been told. By which they paid for the television commercials that we placed on in Texarkana that I did over here at Channel 7, and a tag-in on our own program on Channel 3 Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. Plus, they printed up quite a number of hundreds of placards announcing the meeting and put them up in motels and supermarkets and stores all over town, the local people getting out and handing those out. So they certainly took part in the campaign, and our thanks to them for making it such a success. I hear that Mr. Dart gave you a very fine sermon last Sabbath. He is now working on a transcript of that sermon, putting it together into an article, which will be sent out to everyone. I've got a copy of it on tape. It says on the tape, Ron Dart, the sinner. I put that in the bulletin humorously. There was no comma where there might have been, or there weren't any, you know, quotation marks or something to separate the line, but that's all right. Mr. Dart's the one that pointed that out to me, so he wasn't too chagrined about it. But that's all right. I used to say, I don't care if I have to enter a town that says, come in here, Garner Ted Armstrong, a sinner, you know, on a great big placard somewhere. So maybe it was in that spirit that Ron spoke. But a very good sermon that I've heard bits and pieces from, and I have a tape I want to listen to myself. In that sermon, you will recall that he mentioned the example, probably the epitomization of the example of Christ and of the true ministry of Jesus Christ, being the shepherd who leaves the 90 and the 9, or 99% of the flock who are already safely ensconced in the sheepfold and are Christians and are religious people, and goes over proverbial hill and dale and mountaintop and creek bottom searching for the one lost little sheep. And with great joy, he comes back cuddling and protecting that little sheep in his arms. And as Mr. Dart said very firmly in his sermon, that is only 1% of the flock, but it's 99% of the attention. I mean, the 90 and 9 are over there being taken care of, perhaps by the sheepdog or some caretaker, or allowed inside the sheepfold to fend for themselves. And the pastor, the shepherd, from which the term pastor really comes, it is a pastoral term having to do with grazing and with pasturage, is out searching for that one lost sheep. What I'm about to say may be a little sensitive to some people, but it's something I have to live with, so hear me out until I come to the one point I want to make. In my father's view, I am, in a sense, far more important than the mere one who is, quote, lost, end quote, for I am not merely just another sheep or little lamb. I am his son. Yet in all of these 5.5, nearly 6 years, never once has my father sought me. My pleadings have been met with stony silence, my letters ignored, my phone calls not answered, my attempts to visit him refused, a couple of dozen letters ignored, not answered altogether, the very few, two or three, that he has answered with a roaring, accusative diatribe, saying, and I quote, "The broadcast was ruined," end of quote. I don't know how to answer that accusation. A broadcast that reached every continent, 300 radio stations, 165 television channels, a broadcast that won awards that were listed in gold placards on the wall, a broadcast of network quality that was loudly acclaimed by everyone, a broadcast that my father himself said was the best on television, and used to brag, if that's the term to use, to practically everybody that his son was one of the best speakers he'd ever heard. But yet I have right in there, less than 40 feet away from me, in my file, a letter from my father saying, quote, "The broadcast was ruined," meaning one of the reasons why he kicked me out and took it over with 40-year-old tapes. So I puzzle, because you see, I stand here facing the fifth commandment. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Let's turn to that in the 20th chapter of the book of Exodus and take a look at this commandment. I rarely read anonymous letters. I didn't bring the letter with me, but I did read an anonymous letter the other day. Not only did I read it, but I took it home for my wife to read, and I read it again for the second time this morning. The lady is obviously a member of the parent church, and she, like hundreds, maybe thousands of others, quite confused over the subject of how to respect, how to honor a human leader of a church organization, yet at the same time being confused by outright lies, by inconsistencies, by brutal and harsh mistreatment of individuals. And she is wrestling with that difficulty. It says in the book of Exodus, chapter 20, and in reading to the fifth commandment, verse 12, "Honor thy father and thy mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Eternal your God gives thee." I have heard it thundered that God never compromises one inch with his law, that God's law is implacable, it is immovable, it is absolutely imperturbable, it is as solid, more so really, than the rock of Gibraltar. It's like the proverbial steel wall. You can't make a dent in it. It just sits there, absolutely impervious to all attack or to any change, to any movement whatsoever. Yet only a few weeks ago, Mr. Dart asked the question, "Does God ever compromise with his law?" And his retort immediately was, "You bet he does." I puzzled over that. I heard him out. And you know, I agree with him 100%. There are areas where Almighty God suspended what would appear to have been an absolute edict, a law, a commandment, a judgment, in which exceptions were made. There's a very difficult problem for me personally, and there may have been in your lives, and I've been astounded at the number of letters I've received over the years of people who have said, "Garner Ted, I know a little bit of what you're going through, because when I was well along in age, my father was this, or my mother was that. I even met a person at one of our campaigns not too many months ago, it wasn't this most recent one, who told me that their parent had not spoken to this individual for many, many years. They were completely estranged, and I've been given to understand that that is far more commonplace in families than I ever knew before, that there are families who have had grievous fallings out, who simply do not speak, do not visit, and for all practical purposes have nothing to do with each other. I mean, not at Christmas time, not at Thanksgiving, not via letters or cards. They simply do not pay any attention to the closest members of their own beloved flesh and blood. I am not unique. It is commonplace. Absolute dishonor, disrespect, hatred, contempt between child and parent and child, brother and sister, close relatives, quite rife in our society today. Yet this is one of God's Ten Commandments. What does it mean to honor your father and your mother? I faced that question, wrestled with it quite a bit, did some Bible study, and have quite a lengthy explanation of it in the booklet entitled The Ten Commandments, if you want to reread that at some time. Looking it up in the dictionary this morning, refresh my memory, the biggest dictionary I have says that honor means glory, renown, fame, credit for acting well, a source of credit, great respect, high regard. It means many, many things. The article was that long in the dictionary about honor. It means high rank or position. And I quote now, honor means respect felt or shown in acknowledgement of a person's high character or not also, not and, or position. Respect, carrying connotation in relation to, I want to go on and read the dictionary definition of the word respect. So respect is differing from honor. Really carries the connotation of in regards to or in respect to. If you take the word apart, it means looking back. Re, the prefix, means again, over, back, for the second time. And spect means view, to look or to see. So to see over, to see back again, or to look more deeply, to look twice, to take note of, not to cursorily peruse, but to probe, to recognize, it actually means a tie, an attachment, or to show or feel honor or regard. Literally, respect means, and I quote, both recognizing and properly honoring the worth of someone or something, like we teach children to respect your neighbor's property or to respect the furniture in the home. A soldier, and this is going on to quote the dictionary, may feel respect for an officer he dislikes. To set you up just a little bit, do you respect the fantastic, mass, crowd-moving oratory of Adolf Hitler? Oh, I do. You've got to respect the incredible oratory, the ability of the man to sense and to feel the mood of an audience, respect his use of the language, his playing upon the frustrations and the hatreds and the various vicarious desires for expression of nationalistic desires on the part of a guilt-ridden public who had lived under the Treaty of Versailles and defeat in an armistice in World War I. You have to respect the man's sensitivity to the mood of the mob. You have to respect his almost demonic genius. But do you honor his memory? Would you say you have honor for Adolf Hitler as a man? You might respect his ability. You might respect his tactics. So you see, you can separate the two out, can't you? You can respect, that is, have regard, look again, look deeply, look over again into something, take note of it, and say, I respect that. Does that mean you honor it? Let's ask that question in another way. The present Pope in Rome is multilingual. He speaks probably five languages. He's been in education all of his life. He's gone to the great Catholic universities and perhaps has studied in various areas of the Catholic hierarchy and its university system and its various monasteries or in Rome itself, of which I know very little. He is an humanitarian. He is a humorist. He has charisma. I genuinely felt sorry when I saw on television the shooting that took place in St. Peter's Square in the Vatican. Felt for him as a man. I have preached sermons in which I've encouraged our brethren to try to get inside the mind of the Pope. Is he waking up every morning, as I've asked before, and saying, I am the false prophet. Look how I'm putting it over on everybody. I am fulfilling biblical prophecy. All of the people in the Church of God over there are going to be astounded when I prove to them that their prophecies that they've been preaching for all these years are true. And I'm going to emerge alongside the beast, and I also think it's Franz Josef Strauss, and the two of us are going to move to Jerusalem. We're going to do all these terrible things. No, I really don't think that's going through his mind. I think that man, Karol Wojtyla, is probably astounded that he was chosen by the College of Cardinals. I think he may still pinch himself once in a while, saying, am I the Pope over the Catholic Church, the Universal Church? He may actually, in his own heart, say to himself in his prayers, and I imagine he does pray, he may actually pray to a God in whom he believes. He may believe he is the Prince of the Church, honored with an office that is the succession of a series of apostles beginning with Peter. He may believe it, folks. He may pinch himself and actually pray and say, me, little old Karol Wojtyla from Poland, a Polak pope? You know, he may just wonder, what in the world am I doing in such a high office? I don't deserve such recognition. I'm not really fit for this office. You don't know what's going through the man's mind. He is not necessarily all by himself an arch deceiver. I respect the education, ability, charisma, and apparently sincere humanitarianism of the Pope. I am told in the Word of God to respect his office. I do not obey what he says. I do not believe what he preaches. I am not a part of the hierarchy over which he has control. He could give me an order and I could shrug my shoulders and say, want to give me another one? It would make no difference to me at all. I really don't care what he preaches about. His message just goes off me like water off a duck's back, because I know the organization of which he is head. I know its insidious heresies, its monstrous doctrines. I know its bloody medieval history. I know what eventually it is going to do in a great bloody martyrdom of saints, in which the Word of God tells me that he will reward that great false church double, reward her double for her works, for she has drunken the blood of saints and prophets and so on, and the great elders in the very throne of God are going to praise God's name for meting out terrible retribution to that monstrous system which is yet going to take the lives of millions of human beings. But the Pope is a man. Shall I speak evil of him? Shall I curse his name? Shall I disparage and impugn and ridicule his office? In 2 Samuel 6 and verse 14 is a very interesting occasion having to do with the family, and we can come to that a little bit here right quickly. 2 Samuel 6, and we'll begin to read in about verse 14. David had been down to Kirjath-Jearim. That's a mouthful, but it was a place where the Philistines had kept the ark for quite a period of time, and that town was being blessed for some reason. And they went down, and finally, as a result of the smiting of all these Philistines with hemorrhoids and so on, the ark was going to be brought back, and David went to get it, and they sacrificed, verse 13, oxen and fatlings. And David was so overcome as the king of Israel, the anointed one now to take the government of Israel, he was dancing. He was whirling around and exulting. And I imagine that would be akin to a fan that is just so exulting over a football game that he literally explodes onto the field and tries to rip down the goalposts. And sometimes people do go just a little bit berserk, overcome with joy. David danced before the Eternal with all his might, and David was girded with a linen ephod. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Eternal with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. And as the ark of the Eternal came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and dancing before the Eternal, and she despised him in her heart. Why? We will see later. She misinterpreted his motives. She utterly misunderstood her husband. And they brought in the ark of the Eternal and set it in its place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Eternal. Now it's said that he was clothed with a linen ephod, and you'll see later on he must have taken it off, so that he was now clothed only in what would be like perhaps undergarments, or maybe even some sort of very brief loincloth, because he was perspiring, and a linen ephod was a long kind of a priestly type robe, as a matter of fact. So they were all administering a good piece of meat and bread and a flagon of wine. Verse 19, everybody finally went home after the celebration. Verse 20, David returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came and said, how glorious was the king of Israel today, who uncovered himself in the eyes of the handmaids of his servants, as one of the men of Belial, or one of the idiots, the town idiots here. vain fellows shamelessly uncover themselves, look like the town flasher. Oh, what a spectacle! David said unto Michael, it was before the Eternal which chose me over, or before, or instead of your father, and before all his house to appoint me ruler over the people of the Eternal, over Israel. Therefore will I play before the Eternal. And I will yet be more vile than thus, and will be base in my own sight. There was nothing David felt in any sense constrained him when he honored, rejoiced, exalted before God. And of the maidservants which you have spoken of them shall I be had in honor. Michael did not honor her husband. But the maidservants before whom she thought David was leaping about in some suggestive pose, he said, of them I will be had in honor. So Michael, the daughter of Saul, had no child, and of course we know why. He never darkened the door to the bedroom again until the day of her death. Later on, of course, she married somebody else. Interesting little lesson in human nature here. She utterly misunderstood his motives, leapt to a wild conclusion, judged him in her heart, hated him because of it, and then bitterly heaped railing accusation not only on her husband, that was one thing, but also on the king of Israel, and that was another thing. He chose to speak of it as being lack of honor toward the king. He began by saying, it was before the Eternal, it was in God's sight, God's eyes, it was God's decision who actually chose me over your father, young lady, and before his whole lineage, and appointed me as the king in the stead of your dad, the ruler of the people of God, and those girls you think whose heads were turned, they will honor me. But you don't. No, because she hated him. This was not honor, was not respect. She could have met him in a completely different tone. O my Lord the King, let not thine heart despise me, like the third captain of 50, you just heard. And perhaps I'm off base, David, but I was a little taken aback when I saw you dancing before the people out there, and I had wished I had been there to put your best robe upon you. Oh, he would have said, don't worry about it, Michael. I can understand your concern. But it was this and it was that. Here's the way I felt. She could have given him the benefit of the doubt, met him with a completely different attitude, and got a completely different response. And isn't it that way between human beings, even in the family? Isn't it that way between parents and children? I have run across many, many people who in their childhood have said they were never given the benefit of the doubt of their parents. They were always wrong, no matter what they did. We've seen articles. Mr. Andy and I think wrote one that appeared years ago and perhaps was revised, and we may have put it in the IN, I forget, which was talking about, or was it, was he the author? I forget, but it was about how a father ought to teach a child to mow the lawn. And the child is mowing the lawn the first time, and he's making, you know, crooked swaths, and the father says, you dumb idiot, you little monster, can't you do anything right? Here, give me that lawnmower, go in the house, you know, help your mother wash the dishes, whatever, and then he does the yard or whatever. Instead, he said the way to do it was to say, hey, that's not bad. You got from here to there. That's pretty good. And here, let me help you out this time, and let's go along. That's a good boy. And pat him on the back. And now this time, let's see if we can't go a little straighter. And there's a total different approach. The one is support and encouragement, and the other is just put him down and say he can't do anything right. Basketball coach could tell you, you know, you're the greatest passer I've ever seen. You make the best passes to the other team. Or he could say, you know, you got a pretty good average. I mean, you got a 52% shooting average. You average about 11 assists a game. You don't get many rebounds and so on. You're not that good a ball handler, but I think with a little work you can improve on that. And there are different ways, you know, to encourage children. How does this fifth commandment work with men who are mass murderers, counterfeiters, arsonists, homosexuals, bisexuals, transvestites, thieves, robbers, rapists, spending their lives by their hundreds of thousands in the penal institutions of our land, drunkards, drug addicts, members of the mafia, we understand, have the most tight-knit family structure of any subculture in the United States of America, as the Godfather tended to try to show us. What is the position of the children in the sight of the law of God of a person like, is his name Cooper, who has been on a several years mass murder spree all across, or whatever his name is up here, I've forgotten, and killed at his own insistence more than 100 women? I don't know that he has any family. Does that commandment still apply? Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Now there are honorable parents, and honor is something which can be earned or accumulated. It is something which, according to the dictionary, is credit for acting well. A source of credit, great respect, high regard. Honor means respect felt or shown in acknowledgement of a person's high character or position. Sometimes parents have both high character and the position of being the person who gave you your life, who brought you into the world, who engendered you and gave you their very nature, and the only reason you're sitting here is because you had parents. Then there are cases where parents have not necessarily gained credit for acting well, have not necessarily earned acknowledgement of your respect for their high character, but nevertheless occupy an office in addition to their being your parent, the head of a corporation, the head of their own business, if nothing else, the head of the family. Let's turn back to the book of Psalms 8 and verse 5. We just sang that a minute ago in the song that we had, and I thought that was a rather humorous coincidence. Psalm 8 and verse 5. There are literally dozens and dozens of cases in the Bible where the word honor is used, but this is certainly an important one because it is speaking of mankind in general. I'll read up to it in verse 4. What is man? This is the one that Paul quotes from in the book of Hebrews, that you are mindful of him, and the Son of Man, that you pay any attention to him, you visit him, you have dealings with him down here on this earth. For you, God, have made him a little lower than the angels, and have crowned him, man, the rotten, sinful, cussed critter, with honor, with glory, and with honor. You made him, man, Russians, Indonesians, Indians worshiping Brahma Putrid River instead of Brahma Putra, as it is called over there, and their Taj Mahal, which is a symbol of you-know-what, and cows they think of God, they think of as gods. All these people, all of their savagery, their polytheism, their penchant for human sacrifices, thou hast put him, man, Africans, Asians, Ethiopians, Eritreans, South Americans, put him a little lower than the angels, and have crowned him, man, mankind, including the drunkards, the murderers, and the arsonists, with glory and with honor. You made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. You put all things under his feet. And David exalts and says, O Lord, how excellent in all the earth is your name. Obviously, David is praying and thinking of God's excellency and thinking of man in his best state. Man as a careful preserver of nature. Man as a person who husbands the wealth from the land which God has given him. The word husbandry means actually to gather and to keep and to preserve, and therefore was used for a farmer or the grower of a vineyard or someone who was a rancher and grew grains or whatnot, was the husbandman, because he husbanded, he gathered, he protected, he preserved as the role of a husband toward a wife. So David was thinking in the same way, I suppose, that when we sang the national anthem or America the Beautiful, from sea to shining sea, we're not thinking as we sing those words of the sleazy, filthy tenement houses in Bedford-Stuyvesant, or in Detroit, or over in Hackensack, or in the Bronx. We're not thinking of the wretched perversion of San Francisco. We're not thinking of the pollution that has wiped out the sea otters and the brown pelicans and the oyster beds from Maine to Southern California. We're thinking of the beautiful wheat fields of Kansas, and we're thinking of Mount Rushmore and of the monuments in Washington, and we're thinking of the heroes of yore, and we're thinking of American military cemeteries, or we're thinking of the waving flag in the breeze and of millions of people, and we're thankful for what we have. And so we exult and we honor our country and we salute the flag and we sing America the Beautiful, not America the Ugly. And so David is saying that man is crowned with glory and with honor. Do you honor your fellow man? What about murderers, thieves, and crooks? It's difficult, isn't it, to sort it out. We must obey the fifth commandment. You all have parents. All of you have different parents. I mean, obviously, you've had different experiences with your parents. Some of your parents are dead, no doubt. Some are living. Many of you in this room are parents. Many of you will be parents. It's inescapable if the norm is achieved in the human relationship. And we are to honor our parents. In Psalm 49 and verse 2, Psalm 49 and verse 2. Let me see if I got the right one here. And if I didn't, no, it is verse 12 I wanted. Well, reading up to it again, this again is dealing with man. Their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever. We tend to think of ourselves as being permanent and impervious to destruction. And their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names, like we live in a city named after John Tyler, a president of the United States. And many of the cities, like Chicago, was an Indian chief. And so was Seattle, an Indian chief, and even states named after the Kiowas in Ohio, and so on. So whether Indian or Caucasian, men named institutions and buildings and monuments, creeks and rivers and lands after their own names so that they achieve a kind of an immortality, a permanence, thinking that this will survive them. Nevertheless, man, being in honor, abides not. He is like the beasts that perish. This way is their folly. Yet their posterity approve their sayings. Like sheep, they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them, and the upright shall have dominion over them in the morning, and their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. But God will redeem my ruach, my spirit, from the power of the grave, for he shall receive me. Man, being in honor, abides not. You'd be amazed at the many ways in which honor is used. Actually, if you have the honors, it's even a term used in bridge. It's a term that is used in golf. If you have the honor, you tee off before the other man. The dictionary article is very long, very lengthy on the subject of honor in the Bible. Let's turn to the book of Romans, the 13th chapter. Very difficult with which to wrestle, given some of the situations of which I personally know right here in this county, some of the situations with which I've come in contact in past years, and some that I think all of you would know through the motion pictures you've seen, the books you have read, the news reports you have heard. Chapter 13, verse 1 of the book of Romans, let every person, it should read, every individual, be subject unto the higher powers. For there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resists the power, resists the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves judgment, condemnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Do you agree with that statement 100% in the way, in the vein in which Paul wrote it? To the people to whom he wrote it, thinking of the government of which he spoke, and of that time, yes, it's God's word, you've got to agree with it. But now wait just a moment. Have any of you seen some of the documentaries about what took place down in a couple of states just to the east of us, Alabama? Have you seen what happened in Mississippi back during the days of the Kennedys, which we saw again in documentaries on the anniversary of JFK's murder over in Dallas? The civil rights workers, the free young blacks whose bodies were buried in an earthen landfill to, you know, put dirt for a small dam over here, not too far, I guess, from Selma, Alabama, wherever it was. The many people who were taken out with the full cooperation of the local constabulary, police, sheriffs, county, local, turned their backs and allowed the Ku Klux Klan to murder many, many Americans, white and black alike. They were beaten, cudgeled, and bludgeoned to death. They were shot, burnt, and hung. They were stabbed and buried, who knows, perhaps alive. With not only the complicity of the police, but even in some cases at the behest and the urging of the local police. In those cases, here was someone in power, someone in authority, and your Bible tells you no power is given save that of God. Rulers are not a terror to good works, so given red-necked, stupid, semi-literate, southeastern racial prejudice, given the kind of pistol-whipping judgment for itinerant blacks who might happen along some small town in Alabama and get thrown in the clink for doing nothing more than walking along the street with the wrong color on their skin, are there certain exemptions, certain exceptions to the understanding you may wish to push or to put into this verse? Rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Now, here we have the case of a conflict in power, don't we? The federal government said that the civil rights workers were completely within their rights. They were doing something guaranteed by the Constitution of the United States of America. But this was now a lesser power usurping the power of the federal government. Therefore, they were automatically disqualified. They didn't really have to have all that respect and honor. They could be disobeyed. Of course, you paid the consequences. The pistol, the knife, the garrote. It says in verse 4, He is the minister of God to thee for good. But if you do that which is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. Wherefore you must needs be subject, not only for wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For this cause, pay your taxes, pay your custom, pay your tribute also, for they are God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing. A Christian is commanded to pay his taxes, to give honor where honor is due, and respect where respect is due. And here's what it says, Render therefore to all their dues. Custom, tax, tribute, to whom tribute is due. Custom, and that was money as well, not just meaning going along with the custom of, say, observing Christmas or putting lard in your spinach. Custom, to whom custom. Fear, to whom fear. Honor, to whom honor. How many of you honor the memory of John Fitzgerald Kennedy? Honor his tenure of office in the White House, the way he stood up to Khrushchev, the things he tried to do for the poor, the things he tried to do for the blacks and minorities, the things that he tried to do with regard to America's space program, the commitments that he made to our people. You might honor him in the way in which he carried out his office, but do you honor or respect his person? Do you honor or respect what John Fitzgerald Kennedy was as a man, as you have learned in retrospect in some of the documentaries that have come along? I think you can easily get that point. Owe no man anything but to love one another, for he that loves another has fulfilled the law. And then he goes on to tell which law it was he was talking about. You know, God's word tells us something almost incredible about one of the most powerful beings with whom you can ever come in contact. Let's take a look at the book of Jude and verse 8. The book of Jude and verse 8. I'm going to break in the middle of a thought here because this is actually speaking of demons, of spirits, the angels which kept not their first estate, and they're called filthy dreamers. They are powerful beings, much more powerful than me or you. They have power so that if they were to enter the body of a human being like they did in the case of one man where these seven sons of Sceva, a Jew, tried to cast them out of this man, and these demons that were inside this individual actually just tore into seven people and left them absolutely scarred and bleeding and naked, and they fled away naked. So they're very powerful. They're called filthy dreamers who defile the flesh, despise dominion, and speak evil of dignities, make disparaging remarks, sowing dishonor and disrespect toward those in office or high positions. Verse 9, Yet Michael, the archangel, when contending with the devil, he disputed about the body of Moses, durst not bring against him a railing accusation. He did not accuse or attack the devil personally. Notice what it says, speak evil of dignities, goes right on to say, yet Michael the archangel when contending with the devil. Oh, then the devil is actually referred to in passing in the Bible as a dignity. You're talking of someone in an exalted office. Think about it for a minute. 2 Corinthians 4:4, in whom the God of this world has blinded the minds of them that believe not, lest the glorious light of the gospel should shine unto them. The prince of the power of the air, Lucifer, the light bringer, the light shining star of the dawn, is a twisted, perverted, rebellious, now evil genius, but a spirit being of the same power as an archangel, and in this case, with one-third of all the angelic beings also to do his bidding behind him, all of whom have far more power than any man or a collection of quite a few men. A spirit being on a plane way above us who can actually use a tornado out of a clear sky. Where the weather has not even necessarily advanced on a cold front, they can come along and cause a tornado to just destroy a whole house and kill all the children and all the cattle, as in the case of Job, when God said, all right, I'll just pull my hand away from him. You can't touch his person. And so Satan the devil went down and caused a tornado and just ripped away everything that Job owned. Killed his family, killed his cattle. That is some kind of power. Isn't it interesting? Satan the devil is the god of this evil world. He is called the deceiver of all nations in Revelation 12 and verse 9. He is still on this earth. He has now been consigned to the area of this earth where he is constrained from going to heaven, but he's going to try it one more time, and I'm not confessing to understand perfectly what it says in the book of Job, but even after Satan the devil fell, and Jesus said, I saw Satan fall as lightning from heaven, yet we see Satan appearing, quote, before the sons of God, when the day came that they appeared before the eternal, and God said, where hast thou been, Satan? He said, oh, wandering here and there, and hither and thither in the earth, have you seen my servant Job, that he is a good man, and so on. The devil said, oh yeah, I've seen him, but that's because you bless him. You're responsible for all the good, and so on. You take that away, he'll curse you to your face. God said, oh no. So, all right, I'll take away my hand. Now, there was the devil appearing in heaven. Here's an archangel, not a man, not me, not you, not a woman, appearing in a kind of a mental, but on a spiritual plane, a mental wrestling match with Satan the devil, face to face, looking into those gleaming eyes, whatever he looks like, and saying, the Lord rebuke you, not I rebuke you, not you dirty so-and-so, not cursing or railing accusation, nothing personal, but saying, here is an office. These were two equals, but the one was obedient to God and the other was perverted, but one of them was disqualified but not yet removed, and the other was not disqualified and still occupied his high office. Satan the devil is disqualified. He has corrupted himself, but he has not yet been removed. Think about it. I once heard a minister make that same argument in urging the membership of a church to respect their leader. He made a big point in a sermon that he preached in church after church all over the country. And he said, quote, God will not remove or forsake a man in an high office, even if that man has disqualified himself, and you must remain faithful to that man, even if the man is disqualified. He cited Saul. You talk about the most backward compliment I've ever heard handed to a minister. I don't want any person ever preaching to it. Ted Armstrong, and saying, let me tell you, no matter what he does, no matter how unqualified or disqualified he is, remember the case of David and Saul. God would not remove Saul, even though he was terribly disqualified, so you must continue to obey what he says. Utter nonsense. I cite a subject of Saul's government who had quite a number of other people who followed along with him. Saul was giving out edicts. He was issuing orders. Not only did he issue orders and edicts from his generals in the army, but he took to the field himself. Flags and banners snapping, camels, mules, and horses galloping. Where is David? Get David. Find David. I want David in here. How you dare resist the order of the king? He's disqualified, but he's still in office, isn't he? So let God work it out. I will go, says David humbly, and present myself before the king. No, David said, we better get out of here and hide in the cave. Saul's going to kill us if he can. And so David disobeyed that regal edict and fled with his hardy men to the wilderness of Israel. And you know the account where his heart smote him. And you also remember that even when he walked through the sleeping camp and took the flask of water and the robe and the sword, or was it a spear? I think a spear. And walked up on the hill and hollered down there, "Hey, Saul!" Saul woke up, and here was David, the young man, standing there, waving the water flask and the spear. Saul said, "Oh, for pity's sake, my enemy was right here next to me while I was sleeping on the ground. He could have killed me." And David is saying, "See what I have here?" And David's heart smote him again. He said, "Oh, my Lord, what are you doing out here? You're pursuing a flea. You might as well be on a partridge hunt. You should be out having fun with your men with a spear, maybe on a lion hunt or something. What am I? A dead dog, a piece of refuse, a flea. Why should my Lord the King, great exalted King, be out here messing around, taking your time and your concern, looking for me, David? Oh, David, I'm so sorry." So Saul repented again, burst down in tears. "Oh, David, I'm not worthy," and so on. Could I have my spear back? David is not that dumb. He doesn't walk down, hand it to him. He sends a young man, take it on down, toss it a little bit, let him come pick up the spear. He was very gratified for Saul's response. He wasn't about to walk down and hand him a spear. Still wary. I see a lot of examples in the Bible that help me to understand what a lady asked me for. She wanted to understand, and she is in a situation where she is desperate to understand, how do I continue to honor and to respect my leaders when I find I have no more respect? I still want honor, but I have no more respect. You know, I wrestled with that same problem. Respect flees oftentimes when you find things which just savage respect, which destroy respect, which just obliterate it and leave it in shattered rubble at one's feet. I think that perhaps, without going into any details about where that respect fled, that it was a process that took many, many years in my own personal case. But virtually, it came to the place where there was no respect left. Yet, I struggle, and I say, there is love. I know that, because I know if my father were to walk in his building, I would fling my arms around him and kiss his cheek and be overcome with joy, and I know tears would be there and a great deal of emotion. But would respect come back? Honor? I think that's no real problem for me. Well, that may not be a total truth. I'd better be careful with that, because from time to time I think I slip into moods where it becomes a problem, and I must, with God's help, overcome those moods and, you know, with the Holy Spirit of God helping me to realize what the correct honor is, what is the place in which I should hold Him. He gave me my life. I mean, the very tenor of my voice. The talents and abilities that I have are inherited talents. The work that I did for 25 years alongside my father, whether honored or respected now or even paid attention to, I think it's all been swept under the rug and history rewritten, is nevertheless secure in God's archives. It may not be secure in the archives of the WCG. But that is the only place, the only archives of which I'm really concerned, is God's archives anyway. Honor your father and your mother, God says to Garner Ted Armstrong. And oh, how I honor the memory of my mom. Now I realize I can separate out respect from honor. I can honor the position. I can honor what he has given me. I can honor what he has done. I have little respect as a man. I got a letter the other day that was quite interesting. It was in response to this latest letter I sent out about great departures being made from the basic body of truth revealed to the Church of God and taught by my dad for more than 40 years. It was trying to encourage me, because it was saying, I know exactly what you're going through. I know where you have been. It was saying, tough it out and hang in there. And it was saying, do not worry about honor, because I have had a similar situation and had to struggle with my parent and to find that I could still honor the parent even though respect had fled. I appreciated some of those comments because other people have been there and they fought the same battles. They've struggled for the same understanding of how to hold their parent in a certain amount of honor and love, and yet battling with certain feelings that have come along to plague their minds. I think there are some important things to be seen in David's relationship with Saul. Saul had totally disqualified himself, and David did not just say, "I'll let God work it out." David was actually appointed king before he was anointed king. He was told that he was to be the king of Israel ahead of time. Most men would have been overcome with ego and lust. Most men would have tried to work it out with their own hands. Most men would have tried to have overthrown a man who was already disqualified. One of the greatest accusations rendered against me back in 1978 was that I tried to take over the work. I could trot out a letter for you, it must be all of 9 or 10 pages long, in which my father himself, repeating the acknowledgement of Solomon to David, that David was to become his successor, saying, "You will be the leader of God's people," talking about the real weight of responsibility to descend upon his shoulders, when Solomon was about to die, and my father reprinted every single word of that and used the expression to me that day and in that letter several times that he was, quote, "turning over the reins of the work to me." For years, that was the status quo of the church. In a boardroom meeting, January 3rd, 1978, my father gave me 4 orders, all of which I felt I could not just summarily obey. 1, cancel Big Sandy. That was out of the blue. The other, cancel accreditation. He had told me a couple, 3 years earlier, "Ted, I want you to get accreditation for the colleges. Will they in any way force us to compromise our doctrines?" "Dad, of course not. Brigham Young University is accredited. They got some weird doctrines in my book. It sounds like a science fiction novel when you read some of the doctrines of the Mormon Church. The Western Association of Schools and Colleges has nothing to do with their doctrine. They are accredited. They got a code of honor applied to their student body that I think we should emulate." I talked about the fact that Seventh-day Adventists and Catholics all the way down to the Knights of Columbus are accredited in accredited institutions. That accreditation is not a process which in any way takes exception to the doctrinal beliefs of churches. That is completely exempt. They only want to know, do you give the kind of education to your young boys and girls who come there that you say you do? They are, in a sense, a police force to police the catalogs of colleges to say the colleges, yes, they really do measure up to what they advertise. They are the Good Housekeeping seal of approval for education. They are the Better Business Bureau seal of approval for an insurance agency. They are the government saying this is prime or choice beef. That's all. So we pursued accreditation. It had taken years, probably several $100,000. We expanded the faculty over years and years and years until we had 17 fully developed majors. We had increased the theology department by several professors. I myself asking, to my everlasting chagrin at this moment, in fact, Roderick C. Meredith to come back to take over the freshman Bible class, asked that a young man that I had a great deal of respect for, and still do to some degree, who had been up here in Big Sandy, Leon Walker, to become the chairman of the theology faculty. I had known there was a certain drift away from some solid, positive, basic, fundamental beliefs in Ambassador College, and I was determined to get some of the people from Big Sandy to help me correct that drift. So I sent over there, to my everlasting chagrin as I look back, but hindsight is 20/20, men such as Ron Kelly, to become an associate dean of students. Don Ward, to become the president of Ambassador College. I knew that a president is a very short-lived, short-term person. He can be bought and sold 10 times a year. But a deputy chancellor, a vice chancellor, a chancellor is over a whole state system of universities. I already had that title. Why did I need to be a president? I couldn't be a resident on campus. So, all of those changes have been made, not dramatic changes, very normal, natural changes. We had 1,200 student body. We had spent all of that money. The wheels had been turning. We'd had 17 members of the Western Association visiting on the campus. The only reason that they said we couldn't be accredited was that when they read the financial report and then they looked at the chartering documents, they saw the financial report of the college was on letterhead with Rader, Cornwall, Kessler, Palazzo auditors. And then they saw Rader was the vice president for financial affairs for the college. They naturally wondered that the auditing firm should have the name of the vice president for financial affairs. And they alleged that there might be some sort of conflict of interest and were promptly hit with a letter threatening to sue them from the people involved. Well, I asked, is there going to be any discussion? Mr. Rondart was in that boardroom at that moment. You want to ask him if what I'm telling you is true? My wife was in that boardroom at that moment, if you want to ask her. He said that he had received the resignation of Stanley Rader. I had fought mightily behind the scenes to achieve that resignation for over 2.5 years. I finally delivered it to him on a nice bone china platter. But Rader got to him. They had a private meeting. They came in together from the back door of his office and sat down. Rader turned on his little tape recorder. He sat there and the meeting began. He said, I have received a typewritten resignation from Stanley Rader. He looked at me and he said, I have refused to accept that resignation. The blood drained out of my face. I thought, what? And then he ordered me to do these impossible things. I said, is there going to be any discussion? No, there will be no discussion. And then I made my move. I tried to take over the work. No. I said, well, in that case, Dad, I said, I resign. I turned to get my briefcase. I said, you gave me my life. You can have it back. It's yours. I'm destroyed. There's no reason for me to continue further. I cannot continue at Ambassador College under these circumstances. I resign. I don't need to have these offices. And then he began to discuss. He didn't want me to resign. He wanted me to stay, didn't he, Ron? But I resigned. Take over the work? Ruin the broadcast? Honor your father and your mother, says my God. Difficult. I hope you understand just how difficult it can be. Let's turn to the book of Acts 23. Take a look at what the Apostle Paul had to face one time. And I'll conclude this quite quickly. Acts, the 23rd chapter. And we read of a case where Paul was on trial virtually for his life because they could have killed him. He had the power to do that. He was beholding the council and he said, Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth. Whereupon somebody did. Paul said unto him, God shall smite thee, thou whited wall. Interesting language. He didn't say, I will smite thee. He didn't command someone else to go hit the high priest. He said, God will smite thee, thou whited wall. For sittest thou to judge me after the law, and commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law? Strong words. That's calling a spade, isn't it? He called him a whited wall, like a whited sepulcher. And he said, God will smite you. But he had his little day in court. He had his say, and he went on with the speech, and you see that he discerned that they were both Sadducees and Pharisees. The Pharisees believe in a resurrection, the Sadducees did not. You can read the rest of it, of how it was all, you know, dissolved into a giant riot, a near riot. But interestingly enough, it says in verse 4, They that stood by said, Do you dare to revile God's high priest? Then Paul quoted from the book of Exodus 22:28 and said, I wish not, I wist not. No, that was not my intent, brethren. I didn't mean to do that at all. I wist not that he was the high priest. For it is written, You shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people. Paul was not speaking evil of the man, but he was quoting the law. And he was saying, you are a whited sepulcher, meaning exactly the lesson. And where did he get that from? Matthew 23. You are whitened sepulchers. You are whitewashed tombs, inside full of dead men's bones, said Jesus Christ of Nazareth, speaking of those of whom he said, they sit in Moses' seat. Whatsoever they bid you to do, that do, but do not ye after or according to their works. Now, finally, Satan the devil is a great, powerful being. Who gave Satan his office? Who created Satan the devil? God did. Who allows Satan the devil to occupy an office called the God of this world, the prince of the power of the air? God does. The Bible tells you that you cannot speak evil, you cannot slander, you cannot get personal with and curse the devil. That even an archangel dared not bring personal railing accusation against Satan personally, but had to say, the Lord rebuke you. You're given the example in the Bible that if demons or Satan the devil try to bother you or influence you, or you see a person in whom there is a demon, you cannot do it on your own name, or even the name of Paul, that Paul whom Jesus, who preaches Jesus, etc., like the seven sons of Sceva tried. You can only say, in the name of Jesus Christ, so and so. Or you can say, the Lord rebuke thee. The Lord rebuke you. But you yourself cannot say, I rebuke you, because there is an office there. Do you respect the power? Oh, yes. Do you respect, meaning do you have fear? Do you take note? Do you look again? Do you look heavily or deeply? Because the word respect means weighty and important. Do you consider weighty and important the power and the capacity for destruction that demons and Satan have? Do you honor the devil? I don't think so. I think you can honor an office. I think you can respect an office. But I think you can sort out the difference between the office and the individual occupying that office. I think you can sort out the difference between a person who is in an office and has disqualified himself and that office which remains. Someone said it, I think, when John F. Kennedy had been killed. The president is dead. The presidency lives on. And within moments, Lyndon Johnson was sworn in as the president of the United States of America. Satan the devil must be respected because of his strength, his cunning, his wiles, his subtleties, his doctrines, his scurrilous methods, his deceptions, and his consummate evil skill. For Satan the devil is an evil genius. But you do not honor the devil, even while the Bible says you cannot speak evil of him. More importantly, if I ask you, do you respect the office the devil occupies, is my question, do you obey the devil and just let God work it out? Well, no, of course not. Well, I hope that I've helped you to understand the difference between honoring and respecting, and the difference between being able to honor a father and a mother for their memory, for what they have given you, for the fact that they are your sire. And, oh yes, the one point I wanted to come to in the letter that was sent to me was, the person was trying to encourage me by saying, maybe your sire has disappointed you, but your father never will. Meaning, my Father in heaven, God the Father. And I thought that was well taken, well put. There is perhaps a difference between my sire and my Father who is in heaven above. I have had to wrestle my own feelings into shape, to look straight at the Ten Commandments, the Fifth Commandment in particular, and to ask myself, do I honor my Father? And my answer is in the affirmative. Yes, I do. I honor what he accomplished as a younger man. I honor the ability that he has. I honor what he has built. I honor and respect the office, such as it is, that he occupies. And I'm not saying that I'm absolutely clear on just exactly what that office is. As far as I'm concerned, it is a minister and the head of a church organization. I will not venture to say that I am utterly convinced that that office is that of, quote, an apostle. But that is an opinion of mine, not necessarily something that I wish to teach you. But I believe I can honor my Father. I can certainly love him. It is awfully difficult sometimes to have respect, and I think all of you need to know that difference.